Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
There were those who were never concerned about free speech. They were concerned about chaos.
And chaos is what's playing out at universities across the United States. Violent clashes and hundreds of arrests as tactical police squads move in on pro-Palestinian protest camps, overrunning the grassy courtyards and stately buildings of schools known for free thinking and open debate. Now in the spotlight for clamping down on protest. Welcome to Your World Tonight. It's Wednesday, May 1st, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern. I'm Susan Bonner, also on the podcast.
The Honorable Leader of the Opposition.
What a difference a day makes. No one kicked out of the House. In Ottawa, Pierre Poilievre and Justin Trudeau playing nice a day after getting scolded by the Speaker. And some Canadian seniors woke up with new dental care coverage today. We'll break down the new federal plan and tell you why some dentists are brushing it off. They were some of the most dramatic moments of the protests so far. Violence breaking out between demonstrators at UCLA and a massive show of force by police in Manhattan. A wave of pro-Palestinian campus protest that does not appear to be letting up, even as it meets its strongest pushback yet. Chris Reyes reports from New York.
A chant that continues to ring across campuses in the U.S., even as the ongoing effort to break up the pro-Palestinian demonstrations and encampments in schools have now reached a boiling point. Just this morning at the University of Wisconsin, police in riot gear moved in to clear tents. The situation heated up fast. Mark Lavicott is with University Police.
As our teams pushed forward to try and secure that camping equipment, protesters pushed back, some turned violent, and it resulted in several arrests.
At other campuses, some moments of calm after an intense mobilization of police overnight. In New York, more than 300 people were arrested at two different schools, including Columbia University. New York Mayor Eric Adams blamed outside actors for what happened.
There were those who were never concerned about free speech. They were concerned about chaos. It was about external actors hijacking peaceful protests and influence students to escalate.
At UCLA, classes were canceled today and police were called after fights broke out between pro-Palestinian and counter-demonstrators. The situation got violent quickly. At one point, fireworks were thrown at the encampments, causing a haze of smoke to engulf the area. Kaya Shah is one of the student protesters.
So I just didn't think that it would ever get to this, escalate to this level, where our protest is met by counter-protesters who are violently hurting us.
At Columbia, NYPD officers have been asked to remain on campus until mid-May. Hamilton Hall, the academic building that was occupied by protesters, is now a crime scene. In a published letter, the university's president, Manoush Shafiq, said she hopes the weeks ahead will be used to restore calm and allow students to complete their academic work, adding the university had considered proposals on divestment from Israel, one of the demands from protesters, but negotiations had broken down. White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said President Biden affirms his support for peaceful protests, but added that the recent action to clear campuses was warranted.
What we're seeing is a small percentage of students. That's what we're seeing. They should not be able to disturb or disrupt the academic experience that students have.
As school officials struggle to bring calm ahead of graduation ceremonies, protesters, many of whom our students themselves, are making it clear they're not looking to the end of the school year but to the end of the suffering of Palestinians. Until then, they will not waver. Chris Reyes, CBC News, New York.
A Quebec Superior Court judge has denied a request for an emergency injunction to stop the protest at McGill University. Two students had asked for the court to ban protests within 100 meters of McGill's buildings. The judge rejected that, but did warn protesters to take care with any language that could be interpreted as anti-Semitic or calling for violence. Vancouver police arrested a woman and are investigating whether she violated hate crime laws. A video circulating on social media shows a woman at a protest in Vancouver last week praising the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel. The woman refers to some designated terrorist organizations as heroes. Police say the woman has been released while they investigate. The speech drew condemnation from Premier David Eby, Vancouver's mayor, and others. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he has asked Israel's government to open up more border crossings to get aid into Gaza. He's in Israel today and met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They talked about a deal for an immediate ceasefire and getting the hostages home. Blinken says it's now up to Hamas.
I think this is something that the whole world is watching. And if Hamas purports to care about the Palestinian people and wants to see an immediate alleviation of their suffering, it will take the deal.
Blinken also repeated the U.S. does not support a major military offensive in Rafah without a plan to protect civilians. Coming up on the podcast, India's month-long election intensifies disputes between the country's Muslims and Hindus. Lessons from a troubled maritime fishery from south of the border, plus an all-in-the-family graduation in Saskatchewan. Respectful, restrained, even reasonable? Words not often associated with debate in the House of Commons, at least not these days. Question period devolved into shouting and insults yesterday, with opposition leader Pierre Poilievre ejected for using unparliamentary language. The Conservative leader was back in his seat today, squaring off against Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Though, as Tom Perry reports, yesterday's chaos was replaced by an unusual calm.
Questions. Questions are l'honorable chef de l'opposition.
After yesterday's ugly political slugfest, MPs in the House of Commons were today on their best behavior.
Will he do as the BC government has done? Admit he was wrong today so we can start saving lives.
Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who was kicked out of the House yesterday after calling the Prime Minister a wacko, was today far more restrained, pressing Justin Trudeau to move quickly with BC to scale back a pilot project initiated by the province to decriminalize small amounts of hard drugs.
Will he announce today that he has changed his mind and reversed legalization of hard drugs? Yes or no?
Even Poilievre's MPs kept a respectful silence, with only polite applause and no audible heckling during the Prime Minister's answers.
We responded to British Columbia government's asking for a pilot project. We will, yes, work with them to adjust it in ways that they see fit.
In all, it was a remarkable turnaround from yesterday, about as sedate and even sleepy as question period gets. Not that Liberals were quite ready to let go of yesterday's shenanigans.
I mean, what Canadians saw, it's basically the true face of Pierre Poilievre, you know what I mean?
Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne says the real Pierre Poilievre is the angry pit bull who was tossed out of the House and who has no respect for Parliament or its traditions.
Canadians should be worried, you know, if he's willing to disregard the House of Commons, if he's willing to disregard the institution, if he's willing to disregard his colleagues in the House, what does it say about what he would do to this country?
Even in what was the quietest of question periods, Justin Trudeau prodded Poilievre, accusing him yet again of pandering to extremists. Green Party leader Elizabeth May says it's time for all sides to turn down the heat.
Yesterday was a gong show. And I'm begging my colleagues to look to their hearts and look to their conscience and imagine scoring one day's points in a national news cycle is not worth making a single additional Canadian think, I'm disgusted with all of them and I don't want to vote.
If today's question period is anything to go by, MPs may have learned their lesson. That, or they're licking their wounds and getting ready for the next big fight. Tom Perry, CBC News, Ottawa.
Today, more than a million seniors over 70 now have dental coverage. It's the first phase of a massive public program to help cover oral health care for middle and low-income Canadians who don't have insurance. Marina von Stackelberg breaks down what care is now available and why you may be stuck waiting for it.
So do you have any dental pain right now?
For now, no, but
79-year-old Martin Brissard is getting his teeth checked for the first time in 5 years.
Yes.
The Ottawa senior says his gums bleed every morning.
The dentist is expensive, so is why I wait. Still, the problem was very bad.
He's one of the first in the country to access the new Canadian dental care plan. Today, seniors 70 and older are covered under the National Insurance Program. People aged 65 and up can also now apply online. In total, 1.7 million seniors have signed up so far. Brissard wanted to be one of the first to get an appointment.
I am happy to be here.
So we'll take a look at your teeth here, okay?
His dentist, Dr. Melvin Lee, says he expects to see more patients like him in the coming days.
Where they haven't seen a dentist 5, 10, even more years, simply because they haven't been able to afford it.
They are very excited to have their teeth cleaned.
Hygienist Shannon Maitland drives her mobile clinic directly to patients in the Ottawa area. The National Dental Plan will help cover routine dental work like cleanings, fillings, x-rays, and dentures. Maitland says that's a massive upgrade from existing provincial public programs.
The coverage that these clients do receive might be only emergency-based, and that is when you're in pain and you have a large infection.
But although she's registered, Maitland is waiting a few weeks before booking those patients in to see how the program goes for others. So far, 6,500 oral healthcare providers have registered. That's only about one in five. So seniors across the country might be waiting to get care.
The majority of dentists are not ready to participate in the program yet.
Winnipeg dentist Joel Antel, president of the Canadian Dental Association, says he's not taking part.
I have to admit to a certain amount of disappointment because I was involved in this process very early on and it looked really promising. And then at some point, it just took a turn and became complicated and onerous.
At some point, let's call a spade here. Are you crazy?
Health Minister Mark Holland says Ottawa has simplified the paperwork and will allow providers to directly bill to the plan without signing up. But that won't start until July.
We've got it down now to a process that's as simple and as basic as anything else out there, if not simpler.
We'll take a look at your teeth here, okay?
Dr. Lee says so far things have gone smoothly at his clinic.
I do believe that dentistry should be a part of universal health care in Canada.
And that's why he hopes more dentists will also sign up. Marina von Stackelberg, CBC News, Ottawa.
Historic to some, disgraceful to others, it's the first full day of operation for the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Supporters cheer that more than twice as much oil can now be exported from the West Coast. Opponents point to environmental concerns. Kyle Bax reports.
There's a little less traffic on the main street in Edson. The town about 2 hours west of Edmonton hosted thousands of pipeline workers over the last several years during construction of the Trans Mountain expansion. Providing a boost to business, says Nancy Taylor Hill with Refillery 72, a shop selling soaps and beauty products.
It was so nice to have the restaurants full, the hotels were full. They were very much trying to be supportive of our local businesses while they were here, 100%.
Construction is now officially complete. The pipeline was first proposed 12 years ago and faced several legal and regulatory setbacks. The Trans Mountain expansion will move oil from Edmonton to an export terminal in Burnaby on the West Coast. Energy analyst Susan Bell with Rystad.
It will increase our competitiveness globally and should result in
higher values being returned to the owner of the resource, which is ultimately the people of the country.
Still, many are concerned how it was built, the constant delays and the soaring cost, quadrupling to more than $34 billion.
Yeah, it's been an unmitigated disaster. I mean, for industry, for Canada's reputation, and for our finances.
Robert Cooper is a Calgary-based investment banker with Acumen Capital. The federal government owns the pipeline and faces the difficult task of deciding when to sell, to who, and for how much. Cooper says there will be buyers interested in the pipeline, but only at a steep discount.
If you expect it to recoup costs, then I think this is going to be a white elephant for longer than you think.
Recently in Burnaby, another demonstration against the pipeline. In the crowd is Tim Takaro, a professor emeritus at Simon Fraser University.
Those people do not understand the urgency of climate change and what is coming for us if we don't turn off the spigot.
Climate concerns are growing, yet the world's consumption of oil keeps rising.
The history of energy in the 20th century is a story of humanity's insatiable appetite for energy.
Sean Karaj is a pipeline historian at Toronto Metropolitan University.
I don't think this will be Canada's last major oil pipeline project.
On this project, construction is complete. The first oil tanker is set to leave the port later this month. Kyle Bax, CBC News, Calgary.
Tensions between Hindus and Muslims remain high as votes are cast in India's month-long marathon election. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, running for re-election, is accused of stoking sectarian anger using anti-Muslim language. And conflict between religious communities has spread to the courts, where both sides argue their sacred sites have been desecrated. Our South Asia correspondent Salima Shivji reports from India.
Daybreak in India's holiest city, Varanasi, and a group of people are bathing in the Ganges River. The calm here, a sharp contrast to the religious tensions simmering just below the surface. With a bitter legal dispute between Hindus and Muslims dominating Varanasi's old town, a fight over the Gyanvapi Mosque built in the 17th century when the Muslim Mughal dynasty ruled India. The mosque is the subject of more than two dozen separate legal cases from Hindu petitioners arguing it shouldn't be here, that it stands where there once was a temple. The initial court challenge came from five devout Hindu women. It's a deep-seated feeling in our hearts. We want to reclaim our temple, one of them, Sita Sahu, says. A recent court decision ruled Hindus can now pray in the basement of the contested mosque after an archaeological survey concluded there was once a temple there. It was a brief moment of happiness, says petitioner Manju Vyas, but we want the whole site. The court battle comes during a heated election campaign, with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi gunning for a third straight term and leaning into his party's Hindu nationalist message to secure it. In January, he presided over a grand opening of a massive temple in another holy city, Ayodhya, built on the ruins of a mosque torn down by an angry Hindu mob in the 1990s. It's another spot where Hindus believe a temple once stood. And that lavish ceremony has galvanized a push from Hindu nationalists to claim other Muslim sites across the country, hundreds of them. Modi's party, the BJP, is even campaigning on it. The Muslim invaders looted our treasures, this election video says, and they used to ruin our temples. With words like that coming from high up the political chain, Varanasi's Muslims feel targeted. Syed Muhammad Yassin, who has spent decades filing appeals to protect his mosque, says the fight is exhausting. We're not being heard at all, he says. It feels like the courts are skewed against us Muslims.
What is happening today?
For some historians who say maybe a couple of dozen temples were torn down by the Mughals, not thousands, the court challenges are a deeply worrying trend.
History is being replaced by myths.
A cynical rewriting of India's past, says Professor Saeed Ali Nadeem Razavi, to bring history in line with the Modi government's Hindu-first ideology. Still, in Varanasi, the religious divide deepens as overt Hindu rallies pour into the streets of the holy city, a sign of a shift towards one dominant religion, Hinduism, in a once more secular India. Salima Shivji, CBC News, Varanasi.
southern neighbor is offering a possible lifeline to Canada's baby eel fishery. It remains shut due to safety and sustainability concerns. The state of Maine says it has figured out how to regulate the highly lucrative fishery and wants to share the model with Canada because what's happening in this country is driving down the price south of the border. Kayla Hounsell has more.
It's 3 a.m. and with the only light from his headlamps and the moon, Daryl Young makes his way through the woods down over a bank to the stream below.
We're seeing now gobs of eels that we've never seen.
Baby eels, also known as elvers, are washed into his nets with the tide.
Now we've got 5 pounds.
We've come across the U.S. border to Maine, but this is the way elver fishing happens in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, too. When the Canadian fishery has not been shut down, that is.
I got everybody in f***ing handcuffs.
Multiple videos posted to social media show fisheries officers confronting people accused of unauthorized elver fishing. The federal government has closed the Canadian fishery amidst concerns of overfishing, organized crime, even death threats. Both countries ship the eels live to Asia, where they're in high demand. Last year, they were worth nearly $5,000 Canadian dollars a kilogram. It was more than a decade ago, but Maine experienced similar troubles. It even got rid of cash transactions. Yeah,
banks were running out of money in eastern Maine. Literally running out of money.
Patrick Kelleher is the commissioner of the Maine Department of Marine Resources.
That was a dangerous situation. I mean, my officers were walking up to harvesters and dealers, and everyone was carrying guns.
So in 2012, the state began making changes. It increased fines, made elver violations a crime, and developed a transaction card, swiped when eels are sold, allowing the state to monitor the elvers as they move through the supply chain. In Canada, there is no federal oversight from harvest to export, but the Department of Fisheries and Oceans says it has launched a comprehensive review of the fishery.
I think it's going pretty well.
Maine also carved out 22% of its overall quota for its indigenous people. Here on the Penobscot Nation, Chuck Loring is the director of natural resources.
We don't have any issues going over on the quota. We've been, you know, respectful of that.
Canada has also set aside part of its total allowable catch for indigenous communities. But beyond that, some say they have a treaty right to fish without a license from DFO and in spite of the fishery being closed. DFO says anyone caught with elvers right now is subject to enforcement. Fisheries officers have arrested more than 100 people in the last 2 months. Patrick Kelleher.
And somehow they're getting that product out of the country, which is really unfortunate, because that black market eel that's being caught in Canada is affecting the price for the legal fishermen that are here in Maine.
Both Maine fishers and authorities insist they have the blueprint when it comes to a smooth elver fishery, and they're willing to share it with their neighbors to the north. Kayla Hounsell, CBC News, Franklin, Maine.
Two high school students with nearly 50 years separating them, a grandmother and her grandson from the James Smith Cree Nation in Saskatchewan, are preparing to graduate together. They both say they've overcome adversity to reach this point. And while this is undoubtedly a happy milestone, as Louise Big Eagle tells us, there are far too many other students who won't reach graduation at all.
Connie Stonesand has been walking these halls for more than a decade. For all those years, the 63-year-old grandmother of 11 worked as a guidance counselor and community liaison at the Bernard Constant Community School in James Smith Cree Nation. But that all changed this year.
I've seen a lot of students walking back and forth and how proud they were. And, you know, I wish I could have had that feeling too.
Stonesand never graduated herself, but with her 17-year-old grandson Sage set to graduate this year, Stonesand decided it was time to get back into class.
And I wanted to be able to get a grade 12, not only because I wanted to be able to go further, get further in life. Even though I'm old as I am, I still want to be more educated.
Last fall, the Bernard Constant Community School started a new adult education program, and Stonesand was the first to enroll. And she didn't stop there, going out of her way to make sure other adult education students also got to class.
I go to their houses and I knock on that door and make sure they're coming because I want to make sure they come to school and they get their grade 12 too.
But while Stonesand is on track to graduate, not everyone in her class is. Cody Baptiste is the principal at the school. He says at the start of the program, 33 people signed up, but only half of that will graduate.
It could be that they've been out of school for too long, and they might lack some of the skills that they need to be effective students. So as administrators, we're always looking at these reasons why students might not continue on with their education.
Stone Sand says she went back to school to feel proud of herself and to show people it's never too late to get your education. And she says she's got plans once she graduates.
If the creator allows me, I am going to take training in addiction and come back and work with our youth.
As for Stone Sand's grandson, Sage, he's proud of his COCUM. And while he's less clear what he'll do next, whatever it is, it'll be thanks to support from his family.
I am really thankful for them encouraging us, and me and then my brother and my cousin, they're doing really well in university, and I hope to do the same as them.
Stone Sand and Sage will cross the graduation stage together on June 14th. Louise Big Eagle, CBC News, James Smith, Cree Nation.
Slices one to the gap in left center. Siri on the move, and he can't catch it. It'll be a double for Tyler Black, his first big league hit.
Not a bad debut for Canadian baseball player Tyler Black, hitting a double in his first at-bat for the Milwaukee Brewers last night. A night and a story that only gets better. Black is the son of longtime Canadian sportscaster Rod Black. And when Tyler found out he was getting called up to the big leagues on Monday night, he called mom and dad, who got on the first flight to Milwaukee, making it just in time for the game. The broadcast crew eventually found the family in the crowd, and Dad, who knows a thing or two about doing play-by-play, was handed the mic just in time for his son's next at-bat.
Hit. I think hand-eye from hockey also helps.
There's a base hit to right field for my boy, Tyler Black. Woo! There you go.
That was incredible. He's got tears in his eyes, guys.
Not that the Black family needed anything else to cheer about, but Milwaukee won that game 8-2. Thank you for joining us. This has been Your World Tonight for May 1st. For CBC News, I'm Susan Bonner. Have a good evening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.